Constitution, Johnston broke or rewrote the rules whenever necessity demanded. Outnumbered severely all along his line, in each sector he improvised defenses which, in event of attack, called for reinforcements from less threatened points. His greatest advantage, indeed almost his only one, was that his army was united under a single leader, whereas the enemy forces were divided. So far, his opponents, Fremont and Anderson, then Hunter and Sherman, and finally Halleck and Buell, had failed to work in concert. What he would do if the latter pair mounted coordinated or even simultaneous offensives, from end to end of the long line or even against several points at once, he did not know and could not know, the odds being what they were. Meanwhile, he used the only means remaining. He used psychological warfare, including the dissemination of propaganda and misinformation. He used it with such skill, in fact, that it kept his shaky line intact throughout the fall and early winter and gave him time to shore it up with all the reinforcements he could find. Throwing his troops forward, he maneuvered them in a threatening manner, always as if on the verge of launching cut-and-slash attacks against the danger points. He announced to all within earshot that he had plenty of arms and plenty of men to use them, that far from having any fears about being able to hold his ground, he was about to unleash an offensive that would roll to the Ohio, crunching the bones of whatever got in his way. The bluff had worked best against Sherman, who already had the horrors as a result of the insight which had told him just how bloody this war was likely to be. "I am convinced from many facts," he informed headquarters in a dispatch which his opponent might have dictated, "that A. Sidney Johnston is making Herculean efforts to strike a great blow in Kentucky, that he designs to move from Bowling Green on Lexington, Louisville, and Cincinnati." Presently, Sherman was on sick leave, restoring his Johnston-jangled nerves. If the bluff worked less dramatically on his successor, that was mainly because Buell had a less dramatic personality. At any rate, it caused him to enlarge upon the difficulties that lay between him and East Tennessee, where Lincoln so much wanted him to go. Halleck also felt its effects. They lay at the bottom of his reply that Buell's proposal for a joint advance on Nashville up the Cumberland seems to me madness. To confuse his enemies, Johnston had first to mislead his friends, and this he did. Statements doubling and tripling his actual strength and hinting of an imminent offensive were printed in all the southern papers in hopes that rival editors north of the defensive line would pick them up and spread them, which they did. Yet psychological warfare was a weapon that could boomerang, returning with a force in direct ratio to the success of its outward flight. While Halleck and Buell were counting themselves fortunate that the Confederates did not storm their lines, readers south of the border were also thoroughly taken in by Johnston, who thus compromised his reputation and risked his countrymen's morale by promising victories he knew he could never deliver with the present force at his command. In a final effort to get more troops and supplies, on January 9th, soon after the arrival of Floyd's brigade, which he had been warned would be the last, Johnston sent a personal messenger with a letter to his friend the President, re-emphasizing the gravity of the Western situation. Within a week, the messenger returned. He had found Davis in a disturbed and careworn frame of mind, but that was nothing compared to the state the chief executive was in by the time he had read the letter. "My God," he cried, "why did General Johnston send you to me for arms and reinforcements? Where am I to get arms or men?" The question was rhetorical, but the messenger, who had been primed for it, answered that they might be spared from less immediately threatened points. Davis had heard this suggestion all too often of late, along with the conflicting clamor of governors whose states had Union gunboats off their shores. Petulantly, he replied that it could not be done, and remarked in closing the interview, "Tell my friend General Johnston that I can do nothing for him, that he must rely on his own resources." The slimness of those resources was known to only a handful of men within the limits of strict confidence. Others beyond those limits thought him amply equipped and bountifully supplied, about to launch an offensive. Johnston was therefore in the position of a financier who, to stave off ruin, had overextended his credit with both friends and enemies by putting his name to a sight draft that would come due on presentation. Now that he was in too far to turn back, the president's message reached him like a notice of proceedings in bankruptcy. Kentucky was the only theater in which there had been no major clash of arms. He must have known that reverses were coming, and he must have known, too, that when they came, the people would not understand. They came soon enough. In fact, they came immediately. Coincident with the return of the messenger, Johnston's right caved in, the troops there scattering headlong, demoralized and crying like their foes the year before, "We are betrayed!" Primarily, though, he lost that wing of his army not because of a federal advance, as he had feared, but because of Zollicoffer's rashness and military inexperience. After occupying Cumberland Gap, the Tennessean had been ordered to move 70 miles northwest to Mill Springs, on the south bank of the Cumberland River, from which position he could parry an enemy thrust either toward the Gap, where he had posted a guard, or toward Nashville, 150 miles southwest. However, when Crittenden reached Knoxville, assuming command of the region, he learned to his amazement that Zollicoffer had not been content to remain south of the river, but had crossed and set up a camp on the opposite bank. Here at Beech Grove, with a wide, unfordable river to his rear, the Tennessean was defying a Union army twice his size and attempting to stir up the doubtfully loyal citizens with proclamations which boldly inquired, "How long will Kentuckians close their eyes to the contemplated ruin of their present structure of society?" Despite this evidence of literary skill, Crittenden now began to doubt the former editor's military judgment, and at once dispatched a courier, peremptorily ordering him to recross the river. But when he went forward on inspection in early January, to his even greater dismay, he found the citizen soldiers' army still on the north bank. Zollicoffer blandly explained that Beech Grove afforded a better campsite. He had stayed where he was in hopes that they could talk it over when Crittenden arrived. Then, too, he explained, to the West Pointer's mounting horror, there were reports that the Yankees were advancing, which made falling back seem a cowardly, or at any rate not a manly, sort of action. Investigation proved that the reports were all too true. Not only were the Federals advancing, they had at their head the Union-loyal Virginian George H. Thomas. Whatever his fellow Southerners might think of his treachery in not going with his state, they knew him to be an experienced soldier, not the least of his recommendations being that he had been a major in Johnston's 2nd Cavalry. Faced with this threat, Crittenden saw that to attempt to withdraw would be to risk being hamstrung while astride the river. So he assumed command and did what he could to brace his troops in their Beech Grove camp for the shock which he believed was imminent. What came was not the Yankees, but a week of pelting rain. Despite its chill discomfort, he was thankful, for if it broadened the river to his rear, it also swelled the creeks to his front and transformed into troughs of mud the roads down which the Federals were approaching. A continuous quagmire, Thomas called them, as his army slogged in double column along the opposite watersheds of Fishing Creek, which emptied into the Cumberland just above the Confederate position. Within 9 miles of the rebel outposts on the 17th, he went into camp near Logan's Crossroads to rest his men, dry out their equipment, and plan the assault against Beech Grove. The rain continued all next day, affording Thomas little respite, but presenting Crittenden with what he believed was a chance to exchange probable defeat for possible victory. In its separate camps, the enemy force was still divided by Fishing Creek, which Crittenden figured was swollen now past fording. He would move his army out that night and strike the Union left in a dawn attack. Then, having destroyed or scattered it, he would turn and deal with the other wing beyond the flooded creek. It was a gamble, even a desperate one, but after a week spent sitting in the rain, awaiting destruction while the river ran deeper and swifter at his back, it was a gamble he was glad to take. Zollicoffer approved as soon as he heard of the plan, and at midnight the two brigades, 8 regiments of infantry plus a 6-gun battery and a cavalry battalion, set out on their march through mud and rain to fight the battle variously known as Mill Springs, Fishing Creek, and Logan's Crossroads. They soon discovered the accuracy of the description the federal commander had given of the roads, and after a nightmare march through shin-deep mud, with rain coming hard in their faces out of a darkness relieved only by the blinding glare of lightning as they hauled at the wheels of bogged-down cannon and wagons and the heads of foundered horses, they discovered something else about George Thomas. They were launching a surprise attack against a man who could not be surprised, whose emotional makeup apparently excluded that kind of reaction to any event. Imperturbable, phlegmatic, his calm was as unruffled in a crisis as his humor was heavy-handed. Lincoln had hesitated to make the 45-year-old Virginian a brigadier, having doubts about his loyalty. But when he questioned Sherman and got the Ohioan's quick assurance that he personally knew Thomas to be loyal, he went ahead and signed the commission. Coming away from the interview with the president, Sherman ran into his friend on the street. "Tom, you're a brigadier general," he gaily announced. When Thomas showed no elation at this, Sherman began to have doubts. "Where are you going?" he asked, fearing he might be on his way to the War Department with his resignation like so many other Virginians. "I'm going south," Thomas replied glumly. "My God, Tom," Sherman groaned, "you put me in an awful position. I've just made myself responsible for your loyalty." "Give yourself no trouble, Billy," Thomas said. "I'm going south at the head of my troops." That was where he was going now. After a night and a day and another night spent in bivouac around Logan's Crossroads, straddling Fishing Creek, he sent a cavalry patrol out into the stormy dawn of the 19th to explore the roads leading south toward the Confederate camp. There was a spatter of musketry beyond the curtain of rain, and presently the horsemen reappeared, riding hard back up the puddled road, shouting that they had run into rebel skirmishers in advance of a heavy column. The long roll sounded. Men came stumbling, big-eyed, out of their tents, clutching weapons and clothes, and formed their regimental lines as if for drill, despite the rain and the fact that it was Sunday. All this while, beyond the steely glitter of the rain, an intermittent banging warned that the pickets were engaged. It sounded more like range firing than a battle, but then the pickets came running in front of a double bank of men in muddy gray. Crittenden kept coming. The cavalry clash had cost him the advantage of complete surprise, but he knew his troops were in better shape for an assault than for a retreat back down 9 miles of churned-up road. Zollicoffer launched the attack, and at first he met with some success. The Federals recoiled from that first shock. But things went wrong in the Confederate ranks almost from the beginning. The men were cold and hungry, exhausted from their all-night march. The exhilaration of the charge burnt up what little energy they had left. Also, their flintlocks would not fire when wet, and the regiments armed with them had to be sent to the rear. Discouraged by all this, they saw the blue troops massing thick and thicker as Thomas brought up reinforcements from across the creek, whose flood stage Crittenden had misestimated. The crowning blow, however, came when Zollicoffer lost his sense of direction in the rain. Conspicuous in a white rubber coat that made him an ideal target, he rode out between the lines, got turned around, and nearsightedly mistook a federal colonel for one of his own officers. At this point his luck, which had been running strong, ran out. He was shouting an order when the colonel, a man who recognized an advantage when he saw one, leveled his revolver and put a bullet point-blank into Zollicoffer's breast. A wail went up from the gray ranks. The Tennesseans' men had loved him in spite of his rashness, if not, indeed, because of it. Their strength was mostly spent, and now this loss, occurring in plain view, cracked their spirit. They turned and made for the rear. "Betrayed!" they cried as they brushed past their officers. They ran and they kept on running, their panic infecting the other brigade, which also broke. It was Belmont in reverse, except that the Confederates had no gunboats to fall back on or transports waiting to bear them away. Thomas replenished his ammunition and set out in pursuit, but his adversaries were well down the Beech Grove Road by then. Under cover of darkness, they crossed the Cumberland in relays on a rickety sternwheeler, which they burned against the southern bank. In the battle and the evacuation, they lost more than 500 men, while the Federals, losing less than half as many, captured 12 guns, 1,000 horses and mules, 150 wagons, and half a dozen regimental colors. By the time the pursuers could effect a crossing, there was scarcely anything left to pursue. Retreating through a region which so many of its men called home, Crittenden's army had practically ceased to exist. Tactically complete as the Confederate defeat had been, it did not turn out to be strategically disastrous. Crossing the Cumberland, Thomas entered a region even more barren than the one he left, and though he put his men on half rations, intending to move on Knoxville, the rain continued and the roads were bottomless. He withdrew, and what was left of Crittenden's army finally called a halt at Chestnut Mound, about 60 miles from Nashville. The respite was welcome, but it did not erase the fact that the Confederacy had suffered its first drubbing in the field. There had to be an explanation, or failing that, a scapegoat. And Crittenden was the logical target for accusing Fingers. "Betrayed," the men had cried as they broke and fled. Investigation of what this meant turned up some strange answers, including testimony that the commanding general had been in an almost beastly state of intoxication throughout the battle. Remembering that his brother was a Union general, people began to suspect that his heart was not in the cause. There was even a rumor that one of his messengers had been captured bearing information to Thomas. The South had no joint committee, such as the North had after the Ball's Bluff fiasco. Crittenden was spared the fate of his Federal counterpart, General Stone, languishing now in a dungeon in New York Harbor. But the South had other methods. Eventually, a court of inquiry found the Kentuckian innocent of treason but guilty of intoxication. He was reduced to the rank of colonel, and presently he resigned to serve as a civilian on the staff of an obscure brigadier in the Trans-Mississippi, the dustbin of the Confederate Army. That was still in the future, though, and Johnston had nothing to do with it. For the present, he wired Crittenden to regroup his men and offer whatever resistance he could if Thomas came on after him. The Western commander had graver worries closer to Bowling Green, where he had set up his headquarters as the best location from which to survey his long, tenuous line. For while Buell was lunging at his right, Halleck was probing his left, particularly at the point of double danger, where the incompleted forts stood guarding the parallel rivers that pierced his front. It was here that Johnston was most touchy, and with good cause. Arriving in late November, the engineering brigadier Tillman had reported, "I have completed a thorough examination of Henry and Donelson and do not admire the aspect of things." He wanted more troops, muskets for his unarmed men, and more heavy guns for both places at once. The report had a gloomy, determined ending. "I feel for the first time discouraged, but will not give up." Tillman's gloom was warranted. Neither of the forts was in anything resembling a condition for offering stiff resistance to amphibious attacks. To make matters worse, Fort Henry was located on low ground, dominated by heights across the river and subject to flooding when the river rose. He later declared outright, "The history of military engineering records no parallel to this case." One solution was to relocate the forts. Another was to fortify the opposite heights. Pondering which was preferable, he did neither. Johnston, meanwhile, sent him what he could, so that by mid-January Tillman had 5,700 troops, 3,400 at Henry and 2,300 at Donelson. Then came Buell's lunge and Halleck's probe. Both withdrew, Buell because of the rain and lack of rations, Halleck because he had only intended a feint, but Johnston knew they would be back soon enough. 3 days after the Mill Springs rout, announcing the death of Zollicoffer and predicting a Federal strike against the forts, he made a final appeal to the adjutant general. "The country must now be roused to make the greatest effort that it will be called upon to make during the war. No matter what the sacrifice may be, it must be made, and without loss of time. All the resources of the Confederacy are now needed for the defense of Tennessee." Now, as before, Johnston did what he could with what he had. He sent Pillow to Clarksville, 60 miles down the railroad, within supporting distance of the forts. Floyd and Buckner were sent with their brigades to Russellville, midway between Pillow and himself, within reach of both. Then, as January wore to a close, he learned to his dismay that Tillman at Fort Henry was still pondering whether to fortify the high ground across the river. "It is most extraordinary," Johnston exclaimed. "I ordered General Polk 4 months ago to at once construct those works, and now with the enemy on us, nothing of importance has been done. It is most extraordinary." Mastering his alarm as best he could, he wired Tillman, "Occupy and entrench the heights opposite Fort Henry. Do not lose a moment. Work all night." Johnston was not the only commander alarmed by the success of Buell's lieutenant in East Kentucky. On the day after the battle, still not having heard the news, Henry Halleck returned to his desk after a 4-day bout with the measles. During his time in bed, he had reconsidered the suggested move against Nashville by means of a 2-pronged advance up the Cumberland and the Tennessee. He no longer considered the operation madness. In fact, he wrote McClellan that Monday morning, such an advance would follow the great central line of the Western theater of war. However, he was quick to add, the movement should not be launched without a force of at least 60,000 effectives. As for Buell's proposed simultaneous advance upon the Tennessee capital, he considered it neither wise nor necessary. "It was bad strategy," he wrote, "because it requires a double force to accomplish a single object." Halleck wanted a one-man show, with Halleck as the man. Having dispatched his letter to the General-in-Chief, the convalescent author of The Elements of Military Art and Science sat back and scratched his elbows. It was then that the news of Fishing Creek arrived, and the effect was as if a bomb had been exploded under his desk. What Thomas had done for Buell in eastern Kentucky was comparable to what Rosecrans had done for McClellan in western Virginia the year before. McClellan's elevation had followed swiftly after Philippi, so might Buell's after Fishing Creek, especially considering the fact that the advance had opened the way to East Tennessee, which everyone knew was Lincoln's pet concern. In the glare of that bomb burst, Halleck saw his worst fears outlined stark before him. Buell might get the West. That changed everything. Before he could consider what to do, however, he must somehow recover from the paralyzing shock which was his first reaction to the news. U.S. Grant returned to Cairo on the same day Halleck got up from the measles. His demonstration to immobilize Polk had not only been successful, it had given him ideas. "A fine reconnaissance," he called it, and requested permission to visit St. Louis for a discussion with the commanding general. Halleck by now had the news from East Kentucky. "You have permission to visit headquarters," he replied, as if in a daze, and by Friday Grant was there. He found Halleck vague and noncommittal, still suffering from the shock of his rival's success. Consequently, the interview fell flat. "I was received with so little cordiality," Grant later declared, "that I perhaps stated the object of my visit with less clearness than I might have done, and I had not uttered many sentences before I was cut short, as if my plan was preposterous." He returned to Cairo, very much crestfallen. He was not crestfallen long. On his return, he found a dispatch from Brigadier General C.F. Smith, who had demonstrated up the Tennessee while Grant had been pretending to threaten Columbus. Smith was 60, with a ramrod stiffness, a habit of profanity, and a white walrus mustache. He had been commandant of cadets when Grant was at West Point, but now, as was often the case with old-line officers who had stayed in the service, He was outranked by the volunteer commander and came under his authority. His advance had taken him down near the Tennessee line, within 3 miles of the fort on the east bank of the river, and in his report to Grant he stated flatly, "I think 2 ironclad gunboats would make short work of Fort Henry." On his visit with Halleck in St. Louis the week before, Grant had proposed a general forward movement. Now here was something specific. Returning to the charge, he promptly wired, "Cairo, January 28th, Major General H. W. Halleck, St. Louis, Missouri. With permission, I will take Fort Henry on the Tennessee and establish and hold a large camp there. U.S. Grant, Brigadier General." Halleck was just emerging from his state of shock. Perhaps by now he was even beginning to hear the words Grant had spoken 3 days ago, before he cut him short. At any rate, he saw that he must accomplish something to counterbalance the success his rival had scored at the opposite end of the line, and on second thought this looked like just the something. A week back he had told McClellan that the advance up the rivers should not be undertaken by a force of less than 60,000 effectives. Grant had barely one-third that many men, including Smith's. However, leery as Halleck was of the wild man of Belmont, he knew that when Grant said plainly, "I will take Fort Henry," it meant an all-out effort and quick movement by field-hardened troops. There was the risk that Polk might move forward from Columbus, threatening the line of the Ohio while Grant was on his way southward up the Tennessee, but Halleck thought this unlikely, considering the success of the recent feint in that direction. He was still pondering his decision when a telegram arrived from McClellan, reporting that a rebel deserter had just informed him that Beauregard was leaving Manassas to go to Kentucky with 15 regiments of Confederate infantry. That resolved Halleck's final doubt. He would strike before Beauregard arrived. Next morning, Thursday the 30th, he wired Grant, "Make your preparations to take and hold Fort Henry. I will send you written instructions by mail." Fort Henry being in Tennessee, he availed himself of the opportunity to request an enlargement of the area of his command, wiring McClellan, "I respectfully suggest that that state be added to this department." One thing remained to be done: inform Buell. With his campaign launched beyond any possibility of his rivals being able to claim a hand in its inception, but not too late to call on him for help if help was needed, Halleck telegraphed him curtly, "I have ordered an advance of our troops on Fort Henry and Dover. It will be made immediately." Now it was Buell's turn to be shocked at rival progress. "I protest against such prompt proceedings," he wrote McClellan, "as though I had nothing to do but command commence firing when he starts off." The written instructions Halleck had promised his lieutenant were short and to the point, giving the latest intelligence on the strength of the fort, repeating McClellan's warning that Beauregard was on the way with reinforcements, and including the sentence, "You will move with the least delay possible." Knowing his man, Halleck knew that such words were as apt to produce results as a yank on the lanyard of a well-primed cannon. Grant's reply from Paducah during the daylight hours of February 3rd was the briefest yet. "We'll be off up the Tennessee at 6 o'clock. Command, 23 regiments in all." And so it was. In the gathering dusk, the transports slipped their moorings. The campaign to take Fort Henry was underway. In the lead were 4 ironclad gunboats, unlike any ever seen before on this or any river. They were the invention, the product, and at this stage the property of James B. Eads, who had built them in 100 days on an Army contract let to him in August, when they were intended, along with 3 others, to constitute the hard core of the column that would accomplish Fremont's lopping descent of the Mississippi. The Pathfinder was gone now, along with his plan, but the gunboats remained. Designed for river fighting, they were 175 feet long and a bit over 50 feet in the beam. 2 1/2-inch overlapping plates of armor were bolted to the bows to give protection from head-on fire, and the sides were sloped at 35 degrees to deflect shots taken broadside. For armament, they mounted 13 guns apiece, 3 at the bow, 2 at the stern, and 4 on each side. Despite the weight of all this metal, they were surprisingly maneuverable and drew only 6 feet of water, which meant, in river parlance, that they could run on a heavy dew. Eads, a native of Indiana and a man of industry, was one of those included in the southern sneer at the North as a race of pasty-faced mechanics. When he arrived in St. Louis to start work on his contract, the trees from which he would hew timbers were still standing in the forests. Within 2 weeks he had 4,000 men at work around the clock, Sundays not accepted. When he ran out of money, he used his own, and when that gave out, he borrowed more from friends. By the end of November, he had launched 8 gunboats, a formidable squadron aggregating 5,000 tons, with a cruising speed of 9 knots an hour and an armament of 107 guns. The government was less prompt in payment, though, than Eads was in delivery. He still had not been reimbursed when the fleet set out for Henry, so that technically, the ironclads were still his own. The Turtleback steamers were not a Navy project. The admirals left such harebrained notions to the Army. For the most part, even the sailors aboard the boats were soldiers, volunteers from Grant's command who had answered a call for river and seafaring men to transfer for gunboat service. Once the fleet was launched and manned, however, the Navy saw its potential and was willing to furnish captains for its quarterdecks. Having made the offer, which was quickly accepted, the admirals did not hold back but sent some of their most promising officers westward for service on the rivers. None among them was more distinguished, more experienced, or tougher than the man assigned to Flag Command. Commodore Andrew H. Foote was a Connecticut Yankee, a small man with burning eyes, a jutting gray chin beard, and a long naked upper lip. A veteran who had fought the Chinese at Canton and chased slavers in the South Atlantic, he was deeply, puritanically religious and conducted a Bible school for his crew every Sunday, afloat or ashore. 20 years before, he had had the first temperance ship in the U.S. Navy, and before the present year was out, he would realize a lifelong ambition by seeing the alcohol ration abolished throughout the service. At 56, he had spent 40 years as a career officer fighting the two things he hated most, slavery and whiskey. It was perhaps a quirk of fate to have placed him thus alongside Grant, who could scarcely be said to have shown an aversion for either. But if fate had juxtaposed them so in hopes that they would strike antagonistic sparks, then fate was disappointed. Foote, like Grant, believed in combined operations and had joined with him in bombarding Halleck with telegrams urging the undertaking of this one. Army and Navy, the Commodore said, were like blades of shears, united, invincible, separated, almost useless. So built, so manned and led, the fleet put out in the rainy early February darkness, southward up the swollen Tennessee. 4 ironclads and 3 wooden gunboats escorting 9 transports with their cargo of blue-clad soldiers, the first of Grant's 2 divisions, which together totaled 15,000 men. Having landed the first, the transports would return downriver to bring the second forward. Then the two would move together against the fort, the gunboats meanwhile taking it under bombardment. The initial problem was to locate a landing place as near the objective as possible and yet beyond the range of its big guns. One complication was Panther Creek, which flowed westward into the river, a little over 3 miles north of the fort. A landing north of the creek would mean that the troops would have to cross or go around it. That was undesirable, involving problematical delay. Yet a landing south of the creek might bring the transports under the rebel guns, with resultant havoc and probable disaster. Grant must first determine their range. He did so, characteristically, in the quickest, simplest way, by personal reconnaissance. Halting the fleet in the cold pre-dawn darkness, 8 miles short of the fort, he ordered 3 of the ironclads forward to draw the fire of the guns and boarded one of them, the Essex, to go along and find out for himself. He found out soon enough. The ironclads steamed past the creek mouth and opened fire within 2 miles of the fort. The answering shells fell short until a 6-inch rifle came into action, splashing its first shot not only beyond the gunboats but beyond the mouth of the creek as well. Grant now had the information he wanted. No landing could be made south of the creek without bringing the transports under fire. But then the rifle's gunner made the information even more emphatic by demonstrating the kind of marksmanship the gunboats would encounter in an attack against Fort Henry. Shortening the range, he put the next shot squarely into the Essex. Having secured the information they sought and more, the ironclads turned and went back down the river, the wounded Essex bringing up the rear with a 6-inch shell in her steerage and a wiser troop commander on her bridge. Now that he knew how to do what must be done, Grant went back to get the movement started. The fleet proceeded southward, landing the 1st Division north of the creek, and while the empty transports set out downriver on their 100-mile round trip to bring the 2nd Division forward, he completed the details of his attack plan. The key to the position, he saw, Belmont having taught him just how briefly troops could hold an objective which came under the plunging fire of enemy guns, was the high ground on the west bank, dominating the low-lying fort across the river. Reconnaissance had drawn no fire from there, and Grant had been able to spot no guns through his glasses. But that was inconclusive. Intelligence had warned him that the Confederates were at work there. The batteries might be masked, under orders to hold their fire until a target worth their powder hove in view. Therefore, he assigned the 2nd Division the task of seizing the left bank heights, planting artillery there, while the 1st Division moved against the fort itself, angling around the head of Panther Creek to come in from the east and thus prevent the escape of the garrison in case it tried to retreat from under the fleet bombardment. How large that garrison was, he did not know. There was no way of telling how many reinforcements might have arrived overland from Donelson, 12 miles away, or by rail from Bowling Green or Memphis, since the defenders first learned of the task force moving up the Tennessee. In any case, the right bank attack would be the main effort, and he detached one brigade from the 2nd Division, which had 3, ordering it to land on the eastern bank and support the 1st Division, which had 2. One more detachment from the 2nd Division, a rifle company to act as sharpshooters on the warships, and Grant's attack plan was complete. If Fort Henry could be taken by 15,000 men and 7 gunboats, he was going to take it. There were other problems. The fact that the river was mined, for instance, which meant that at any minute any vessel, ironclad or transport, was apt to go sky-high in smoke and flame, the attacking force reduced to that extent by quick subtraction. Contact mines, or torpedoes as they were called, were a new and formidable weapon, a fiendish example of rebel ingenuity. Anchored to the river bottom by cables that held them upright under water, they were equipped with pronged rods extending upward to just below the surface, ready to trip the detonators on contact. The rising river had reduced their effectiveness, some being submerged by now beyond scraping distance, and others floating around loose, torn from their moorings, but there was still a good deal of conjecture and concern about them. On the afternoon of the 5th, while in conference with Foote and the 2 division commanders aboard the flagship, Grant got a chance to make a first-hand inspection of one of these new implements of war. A gunboat tied up alongside, and her captain sent word that he had fished a torpedo out of the river. He had it there on deck, he said, in case the Commodore and the generals wanted to see it. They did indeed want to see it, if only as a diversion. The conference was about finished anyhow. Little remained to be done except to await the arrival of the 2nd Division, still being brought in relays from Paducah. Crossing over to the gunboat, the Commodore and his aides and the generals and their staffs clustered on the fantail and stood in a semicircle looking down at the torpedo. It appeared to be quite as dangerous as they had feared. A metal cylinder 5 feet long and 1.5 feet in diameter, the thing was made especially venomous-looking by the pronged rod extending from its head. Grant wanted more than a look, however. He wanted to know how it worked, So the ship's armorer came with his wrenches and chisels, and while he tinkered, the interested officers watched. Suddenly, as he was loosening a nut, the device emitted an ominous hissing sound, which seemed to be mounting swiftly toward a climax. The reaction of the watchers was immediate. Some ran, exploding outward from the semicircular cluster, while others threw themselves face downward on the deck. Rank had no precedent. It was each man for himself. Foot sprang for the ship's ladder, and Grant, perhaps reasoning that in naval matters the Commodore knew best, was right behind him. If he lacked the seaman's agility in climbing a rope ladder, he made up for it with what one witness called commendable enthusiasm. At the top, the Commodore looked back over his shoulder and found Grant closing rapidly upon him. The hissing had stopped. Whatever danger there had been was past. Foote smiled. "General, why this haste?" he asked, and his words, though calmly spoken, were loud against the silence. "That the Navy may not get ahead of us," Grant replied. Lloyd Tillman was slim and dark-skinned, with a heavy, carefully barbered mustache and chin-beard, an erect soldierly bearing and piercing black eyes intensifying what one observer called a resolute, intelligent expression of countenance. His resolution had not waned, but after 2 days of watching the Federal build-up to his front, he was beginning to realize that the fate of the fort was scarcely less predictable than that of a shoe-nail about to be driven by a very large sledge-hammer lustily swung. His 3,400 men were miserably armed with hunting rifles, shotguns, and 1812-style flintlocks, and his cannon were scarcely better. Two out of a shipment cast from what looked like pot metal had burst in target practice, and several others had been condemned, a British observer pronouncing them less dangerous to the enemy than to the men who served them. Tillman was threatened, in fact, by more than the gunboats and the blue-clad infantry, and weakened by more than the shortage of serviceable arms. In 1 week, back in mid-January when the rains came, the river had risen 14 feet, demonstrating graphically the unwisdom of the engineers who had sighted Fort Henry at this particular bend of the Tennessee. Only 9 of the 15 guns bearing riverward remained above water in early February, and now, while the river continued to rise, lapping at last at the magazine, it had become a question of which would get there first, Floodcrest or the Yankees. In spite of all this, the Kentucky Brigadier did not despair when his lookout, peering downriver through the rainy dawn of the 4th, announced the approach of gunboats and behind them the coal smoke plumes of the transports winding northward out of sight. Determined to fight, he wired Polk for reinforcements from Columbus, and the following day, having turned back the ironclad reconnaissance and seen that the Federals were landing in force 3 miles north of the fort, he wired Johnston at Bowling Green, "If you can reinforce strongly and quickly, we have a glorious chance to overwhelm the enemy." Accordingly, he sent his troops with their squirrel guns and fowling pieces to man the rifle pits blocking the landward approaches. If no help came, he would fight with what he had. However, as the day wore on and the transports returned with further relays of northern troops, he began to realize the full length of the odds, particularly on the opposite bank, where the Union brigades were landing and preparing to move against the unfinished, unmanned works on the high ground which dominated the shipwrecked fort on this side. Without losing his resolution to give battle, he saw clearly that whoever stood on this nailhead under the swing of that sledge was going to be destroyed, and he saw, too, that whatever his personal inclination, his military duty was to save what he could of a command whose doom was all but sealed. At a council of war called that night in the fort, the enemy build-up continued, seemingly endless, 3 miles downriver on both banks. He announced his decision. While a sacrifice garrison manned whatever guns were yet above water, discouraging pursuit, the infantry would be evacuated, marching overland to join the troops at Donelson. Next morning, a company of Tennessee artillery, 2 officers and 54 men, took their posts at the guns, awaiting the attack they knew was coming, while the foot soldiers filed out of the rifle pits and the fort, taking the road eastward. Tellman went a certain distance to see them on their way, and then, still resolute, turned back to join the forlorn hope. It was noon by now. As he drew near, the sound of guns came booming across water. 2/3 by land, 1/3 by water. Grant's triple-pronged upriver attack, designed as a simultaneous advance by the two divisions, one along each bank while the gunboats took the middle, was slated to get underway at 11 o'clock, by which time the final relay of troops had arrived from Paducah. Both infantry columns went forward on schedule, but Foote, on his own initiative, held back until almost noon, allowing the landsmen at least a measure of the head start they needed. The rain had stopped. The sun came through, defining the target clearly, and there was even a light breeze to clear away the battle smoke and permit the rapid and accurate fire the Commodore expected of his gunners. For almost an hour the crews stood by, converted soldiers and freshwater sailors bracing themselves for their first all-out action, with just enough men-of-war's men, as one skipper said, to leaven the lump with naval discipline, until the attack pennant was hoisted and the squadron moved upstream, the ironclads steaming four abreast in the lead and the three wooden gunboats bringing up the rear. "The flagship will, of course, open the fire," Foote had ordered, and at 1,700 yards she did so. The others joined the chorus, firing as many of their 54 guns as could be brought to bear on the fort, whose 9 gun crews stood to their pieces and replied at once in kind, loosing what one of the defenders proudly called as pretty and as simultaneous a broadside as I ever saw flash from the sides of a frigate. This continued, preceded by one broad and leaping sheet of flame, as the same defender said. The ironclads deliberately closed the range to 600 yards while the more vulnerable wooden vessels hugged the western bank, adding the weight of their metal to the pressure on the earthworks. Based as it was on predetermined ranges, fire from the fort was accurate and fast. For a time, at least, the Tennessee artillerists seemed to be inflicting the greater damage. Aboard the warships, men were deafened by the din of solid shot pounding and breaking the iron plates and splintering heavy timbers, while shells screamed and whistled in the rigging, bursting, raining fragments. Foote's flagship, the prime target, was struck 32 times in the course of the action, 2 of her guns disabled and her stacks, boats, and after-cabin riddled. The captain of the ironclad on her left, which took 30 hits, said of one shot which he saw strike the flagship, "It had the effect, apparently, of a thunderbolt, ripping her side timbers and scattering the splinters over the vessel. She did not slacken her speed, but moved on as though nothing special had happened." Not so the luckless Essex. Patched up from the hurt she had received 2 days ago, she took another now through her boiler, an unlucky shot which left her powerless in a cloud of escaping steam, with 28 scalded men aboard, some dead and others dying. Out of control, she swung broadside to the current, then careened, leaving a gap in the line of battle, and drifted downstream out of the fight. Encouraged by this proof that the turtleback monsters could be hurt, the defenders cheered and redoubled their efforts. But they had done their worst. In fact, their all. For now there followed a series of accidents and mishaps which abolished whatever chance they had had for victory at the outset. Only 2 of their guns could really damage the ironclads, the high-velocity 6-inch rifle, which had already proved its effectiveness, and a giant Columbiad, which made up for its lack of range by the heft of its 128-pound projectile. The rest, low-sighted as they were with their muzzles near the water, could do no more than bounce their 32- and 42-pound shells off the armored prows of the attackers. First to go was the rifle, which burst in firing, disabling not only its own crew but also those of the flanking pieces. Next, the big Columbiad was spiked by a broken priming wire and thus put out of action, despite the efforts of a blacksmith who attempted to repair it under fire. Of the 7 cannon left, which could only dent the armor and shiver the timbers of the gunboats, one had to be abandoned for lack of ammunition, and 2 were wrecked almost at once by enemy shells. That left 4 guns to face the fire of the attackers, the range now being closed, almost point blank. And even those 4 were served by skeleton crews, scraped together from among the survivors. These included Tillman. The fort commander had returned from seeing the infantry off and was serving as a cannoneer at one of the 4 pieces. He had asked the artillerists to hold out for an hour, affording the garrison that much of a head start on its march to Donelson. Now that they had held out 2, with the long odds growing longer all the time, the tactical considerations had been satisfied twice over, and those of honor as well. He ordered the flag struck. It was done, and the firing ceased. "That the Navy may not get ahead of us," Grant had said, and it was as if he spoke from prescience. In the combined attack as in the scramble up the ladder, Foote came out on top. The Navy fired not only the first shot and the last, but also all the shots between, and suffered all the casualties as well. 12 killed and missing and 27 wounded, compared to the fort's 10 killed and missing and 11 wounded. In fact, the Navy's closest rival was not the Army, but the river. Another few hours would have put the remaining cannon under water. As it was, the cutter bearing the naval officers to receive the formal surrender pulled right in through the sally port. Tillman was waiting for them. He had already earned their respect by his bravery as an opponent, and now, by the dignity of his bearing as a prisoner, he won their sympathy as well. However, his reception of the copy-hungry northern correspondents who were soon on hand to question him was less congenial. As a southern gentleman, he believed there were only 3 events in a man's life which warranted the printing of his name without permission: his birth, his marriage, and his death. So that when a Chicago reporter asked him how he spelled his name, he replied in measured terms, "Sir, I do not desire to have my name appear in this matter, in any newspaper connection whatever. If General Grant sees fit to use it in his official dispatches, I have no objection, sir, but I do not wish to have it in the newspapers." "I merely asked it to mention as one among the prisoners captured," the correspondent said, but the Confederate either did not catch the dig or else ignored it. "You will oblige me, sir," he repeated, as if this put an end to the matter, "by not giving my name in any newspaper connection whatever." Grant arrived at 3 o'clock, by which time the Stars and Stripes had been flying over the fort for nearly an hour. His 2 divisions were still toiling through the mud on opposite banks of the river, one bogged down in the backwater sloughs of Panther Creek, and the other slogging toward the empty western heights. Who won the race meant less to him, however, than the winning, and neither meant so much, apparently, as the fact that more remained to be accomplished. He had his mind on the railroad bridge 15 miles upriver, over which Johnston could speed reinforcements from flank to flank of his line. The 3 wooden gunboats were dispatched at once to attend to it, which they did in fine style that same day. Nor was that all. Continuing on to Muscle Shoals, the head of navigation, they destroyed or captured 6 Confederate vessels, including a fast 280-foot Mississippi steamboat being converted into an ironclad. Intended as an answer to the fleet of the invaders, she became instead a member of that fleet and saw much service. This 150-mile gunboat thrust all the way down past Mississippi and into Alabama was dramatic proof of the fruits resulting from control of the Tennessee. A highway of invasion had been cleared. Yet Grant had his eye on another goal already. Another fort on another river 12 miles from the one he had just taken, as was shown by his wire to the theater commander on the day of his success. "Fort Henry is ours," the dispatch began, and ended with a forecast. "I shall take and destroy Fort Donelson on the 8th and return to Fort Henry." Halleck passed the word along as promptly to McClellan, repeating Grant's first sentence and adding 2 of his own. "Fort Henry is ours. The flag of the Union is reestablished on the soil of Tennessee. It will never be removed." 2. Grant was not alone in his belief that he could take and destroy the Cumberland Fortress. Albert Sidney Johnston thought so too. When word of the fall of Henry reached his headquarters at Bowling Green next day, he relayed the news to Richmond, adding that Fort Donelson was not long tenable. In fact, such was his respect for the promptness and power with which the ironclads had reduced their first objective, he wrote that he expected the second to fall in the same manner, without the necessity of the Federals employing their land force in cooperation. All the events he had feared most, and with good cause, had come to pass. Right, left, and center, his long defensive line was coming apart with the suddenness of a shaky split-rail fence in the path of a flood. His right at Mill Springs had been smashed, the survivors scattering deep into Tennessee, while Buell inched toward Bowling Green with 40,000 effectives opposing Hardee's 14,000. The loss of Henry and its railroad bridge, with Federal gunboats making havoc up the river to his rear, had split his center from his left, outflanking Columbus and Bowling Green and rendering both untenable. When Donelson fell, as he expected, in short order, the gunboats would continue up the Cumberland as they had done up the Tennessee, forcing the fall of Nashville, his main depot of supplies, and cutting off the Army of Central Kentucky from the southern bank. This left him two choices, both unwelcome. With his communications disrupted and his lines of reinforcement snapped, he could stand and fight against the odds, opposing two converging armies, each one larger than his own. Or he could retreat and save his army while there was time, consolidating south of the river to strike back when the chance came. Whichever he did, one thing was clear: the choice must be made quickly. All those sight drafts he had signed were coming due at once. The long winter's bluff was over. The uses of psychological warfare were exhausted. He was faced now with the actual bloody thing. He called at once a council of war to confer with his two ranking generals. One was Hardee, commander of the center, whose prominent forehead seemed to bulge with knowledge left over from what he had packed into the tactics. The other was Beauregard. The hero of Sumter and Manassas had arrived 3 days ago, but there were no 15 regiments in his train, only a handful of staff officers. Davis had long since warned that he could spare no more soldiers, and he meant it. But apparently he could spare this one, whom many considered the finest soldier of them all, and by sparing him solved the double problem of removing the Creole's busy pen from the proximity of Richmond and silencing those critics who cried that the president had no thought for the Western Front. Beauregard had come to Kentucky believing that Johnston was about to take the offensive with 70,000 men. When he arrived and learned the truth, he reacted with a horror akin to that of Crittenden at Zollicoffer's rashness, and like Crittenden, he at first proposed an immediate withdrawal. By the time of the Council of War, however, he had managed to absorb the shock. His mercurial spirits had risen to such an extent, in fact, that the news of the fall of Henry only increased his belligerency. At the council, held in his hotel room on the afternoon of the 7th, the general was indisposed, down with a cold while convalescing from a throat operation he had undergone just before leaving Virginia. He proposed in a husky voice that Johnston concentrate all his troops at Donelson, defeat Grant at that place, then turn on Buell and send him reeling back to the Ohio. Johnston shook his head. He could not see it. To give all his attention to Grant would mean abandoning Nashville to Buell, and the loss of that transportation hub, with its accumulation of supplies, would mean the loss of subsistence for his army. Even if that army emerged victorious at Donelson, which was by no means certain, since Grant might well be knocking at the gate already, his invincible ironclads out in front, and his numbers doubled by reinforcements from Missouri and Illinois, it would then find Buell astride its communications, possessed of its base, twice its strength, and fresh for fighting. Johnston's army was all that stood between the Federals and the conquest of the Mississippi Valley. To risk its loss was to risk the loss of the valley, and to lose the valley, Johnston believed, was to lose the war in the West. It was like the poem about the horseshoe nail. Fort Henry was the nail. Beauregard at last agreed. Along with Hardee, he signed his name approving the document by which Johnston informed Richmond that, Henry having fallen and Donelson being about to fall, the army at Bowling Green would have to retreat behind the Cumberland. For the present, at least, Kentucky must be given up. Preparations for the evacuation began at once. 4 days later, with Buell still inching forward, the retrograde movement began. The garrison at Donelson was expected to hold out as long as possible, keeping Grant off Hardee's flank and rear, then slip away, much as Tillman's infantry had slipped away from Henry, to join the main body around Nashville. Beauregard was up and about by then, helping all he could, but Johnston had a special use for him. Columbus, being outflanked, must also be abandoned. Severed already from headquarters control, it required a high-ranking leader who could exercise independent command. That meant Beauregard. After a final conference with Johnston, who reached Nashville with the van of his army 1 week after the Council of War at Bowling Green, he started for Columbus. His instructions empowered him to give up that place, if in his judgment it was necessary or advisable to do so, then fall back to Island 10, where the Mississippi swung a lazy S along the Tennessee line, and to Fort Pillow, another 60 airline miles downriver. Charged with the conduct of a retreat, the Creole's spirits flagged again. His heart was heavy, he wrote to a friend in Virginia. I am taking the helm when the ship is already on the breakers, and with but few sailors to man it. How it is to be extricated from its present perilous condition, Providence alone can determine.